Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Would you join me as I ask God to join us here today? God, I welcome you into this room, into my heart. I know that it will be impossible to share the story that my ego wants to share today, so I ask that instead that I share what you would have me share. The stories that are most useful to those that will be listening, and that my past may be useful. My name is Marion. God loved me enough to put a crack cocaine addict in my life. The alcoholic love triangle that I lived in for 8 years was not bad enough for me to find a relationship with God. In February of 1992, in a Brandley new purchased home to get away from him, I, in desperation, slid down my wall and I prayed to a God I did not understand. And I asked for help. I somehow found my way to an Al-Anon meeting. I didn't even know what the hell that was. Didn't know why I needed it. I was seeking solution to my problem, and that was he would not stop drinking. I had an obsession with every single thing that he did. It was a love triangle, so of course there was also what are they doing, not just what am I doing. I spent hours, back in the 90s, Mervyn's had that commercial, open, 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 open. That's what I did. I sat in the house at night listening for him. And I would stare out the window, and when I was too tired to continue to stare out the window for hours, for days, I would go to bed and I would have listening ears for his car. And believe it or not, I could hear his car coming 2 blocks away. And I would promise myself I'm not going to scream and yell. I would welcome him home happily, which of course never happened. I always went running to the door, wanting to know where the hell you were and why you weren't here and how could you treat me that way again. I honestly thought that I had the power to get somebody else to do something different. I begged him to stop using and to stop seeing her, or drinking in this case. That only pushed him farther away from me. What happened is I stopped trusting myself. I stopped trusting my senses. I stopped trusting the thoughts that were coming into my head. I stopped trusting my intuition. There was one time that he was gone for 7 days, and when he came back, he convinced me he had just gone to get a pack of cigarettes, and I ended up believing him. At another point in time, he was rolling his cigarettes on the kitchen table, and I said to him, those were marijuana, and he said, of course they're not marijuana, these are just cigarettes. It wasn't until years later, and we were no longer together, that I was changing the light bulb in the bathroom. If you want to know where they hide their shit, it's usually on top of the medicine cabinet in the bathroom. And there was all of the cigarette wrappings and cigarette stuff. And of course it wasn't. But I forgot, I stopped trusting myself. When I came into Al-Anon, there were three things that I was told. I didn't cause it, I can't cure it, and I can't control it. I do contribute. That's my fourth C. How do I contribute to the family disease of alcoholism or addiction? And I contributed to the craziness and the chaos in my household. He would beg me, I don't want to argue with you. And I had no other ways of communication but anger. I had no other ways of being except for full anxiety. My sister thought I was quite strange when I said, I need to find a mascara that doesn't run when I cry. And her response was, how much do you cry? And my answer was, every day, all day, of course. I couldn't hold it together for any, really, honestly, for any time period. My coworkers used to call me Grandma, which it wasn't until probably, I don't know, at least 10 years later that I realized that they were calling me Grandma because I wanted to be in charge of everything. And I wouldn't, you know, I had a really stern thumb on not only the people in my life that were personal, but also my coworkers. I had no idea. I went to work one time in Mobile, Alabama, and I walked around the truck, and there was a gentleman standing there. I had didn't even see his face. I just saw the back of him. And he turned around, and instantly I knew he was the next, he was my guy. Crack cocaine addict. We had lots of common friends. And the other relationship, let me tell you real quick, I tried for 8 years to get out of that relationship. 8 years I lived in an alcoholic love triangle. And all I would do was plan a scuba diving vacation, tell him I never wanted to see him again, come home. He would not say anything about it. I would not say anything about it. All I did was plan another scuba diving vacation. And it went on like that for 8 years until I met the crack cocaine addict. And that was motivation for me to get rid of the alcoholic love triangle, to trade up. I remember one of our first conversations on the phone, he lived in Pittsburgh, one of the first conversations on the phone was that, I'm an addict. That really could be a problem for you. And I said, oh, I'm an addict too. Not having any idea what that meant. Living in alcoholism, maybe eating too much ice cream, doing things to extreme is very different than living with an addict, an active addict. There's danger involved. There's fear. There's worry. He was in recovery. All right, let me rephrase that. He went to CA meetings, NA meetings, and AA meetings and continued to use drugs, and mostly crack cocaine. And he continued to lose his car to the crack dealer. And he continued to not show up at work when he was supposed to show up at work. He's my angel. I know we all go through pain. We all go through a great deal of pain watching those that we love kill themselves with drugs and alcohol. He didn't get sober, but it was so bad that I had no choice but to find a loving God that would give me peace and comfort no matter what. And we were just at a funeral recently, and one of the songs that they sang at the funeral was Make God Your Friend. And a lot of people got up and spoke about the spiritual way of life. And I sat in my pew with so much gratitude that I am not alone any longer. That I have a relationship with a God that can carry me through anything. And that is because the person that I was in love with would not stop using crack cocaine. Because the other person stopped using alcohol for a number of years when we were together. You know, 1992 is when I slid down the wall and went to my first meeting. I stayed for 7 months. And I don't remember it. I only have journal writings and a daily reader and a newcomer pack to prove that I was there. Because it wasn't bad enough. It was bad enough. I had met my match when it came to crack cocaine, and I never put it in my body. And at that point in time, I never even saw anybody using it because he lived in a different city. And because when he did come to live with me, he would leave. He was not somebody who wanted to use and when you were around. So I never even saw what it looked like. But yet it completely controlled my life. It controlled what I thought. It controlled what I did. It encompassed my actions. Everything was based around it. I had one time, I had a trip planned to the Red Sea to go scuba diving. And I have rheumatoid arthritis in every joint in my body, and it also looks like decompression sickness, the symptoms. So I was planning on going to this trip, and he was not doing well. So my choice was stay home and make sure he stays sober, or go to the Red Sea to go scuba diving and then go to Egypt for another 20 days. Well, I lied to myself, because this is a disease of deception. I lied to myself that the reason I didn't go to the Red Sea was because my arthritis looked like decompression sickness and I wouldn't be able to dive. The truth is, I did not go on that trip because you can't leave an addict alone at home. They might do something stupid. It took many years in recovery before I came to the conclusion that I had lied to myself. The chapter about more about alcoholism is all about the lies that I tell myself. It'll be okay. It's not that bad. He will come home. He really does love me. This will end. I'm a strong lady. I actually thought I had power over my own thoughts and my emotions before I came in here. I didn't have power over any of that stuff. He would start using, and I would do stuff that made no sense to me. Throw 6 feet plants at him. Try to run him over with my car. Get thrown out of the bar when I'm the one who went in there to save him. Those were not things that came to me out of reason. They came to me out of obsession, out of disaster, out of desperation. To stop what was happening in my household. When I started dating the crack cocaine addict, he took me to Cocaine Anonymous. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in 1997. My commitment date to being a member of Al-Anon is August 17th, 1997. I don't have a sobriety date. And I don't have an abstinence date. I have a commitment date to being an active member of a fellowship, to working these 12 steps with a sponsor, to recovering from a hopeless state of mind and body. That's what I have. That commitment date is 1997. There was myself and a woman in this meeting. There was just two of us. But down the hall was a whole bunch of addicts having a lot of fun on a Friday night. Laughing. And I always wanted to be in there. He would go use. I would go to the meetings. I would go to 3 Al-Anon meetings a week and 2 CA meetings also a week. And they embodied me. They loved me. Last night when we heard the speaker, she was talking about CA is love. They loved me. They practiced the suggestion in working with others that says, even if the person does not recover, the family should be offered this way of life. And they took me under their wing. And they didn't ask me, where is he, how he's doing, let's go get him out of the gutter. They said, how are you? They said, have you gotten a sponsor? Are you practicing the steps? They treated me no different than if I was an addict myself. And I am indebted to them. I've always felt a part of Cocaine Anonymous. And when we had Al-Anon in Denver, a part of that. I currently have a home group because we started a new meeting in Denver at we're almost a year old. June 1st would be our very first birthday. And I'm very excited to be living in recovery and being able to speak 100% honest at a meeting and not have to pretend that it's alcohol that I'm talking about, because it wasn't alcohol. It was far more than that. I got my first sponsor only because I was in a 4-step meeting, and it was maybe 8 or 9 months into recovery. I had been sponsoring myself. That's the ism of alcoholism. I had been going through the slogans. in the literature. I had been going to every meeting I possibly could. I had even journaled a little here or there, and I thought I was doing pretty darn well. Every CA meeting we went to, they asked him if he had a sponsor or not, but nobody really asked me that much in my fellowship. It was a four-step meeting. Vince says only a few words when he shares. He said, if you have not done a four-step, you're still a newcomer. I was outraged. You cannot call me a newcomer. I've been sitting in here for a long time. I've chaired meetings. I've put chairs away. I read the literature. Please. But what happened that night was I got motivated to get a sponsor and to do this work and to change my life and to not have my serenity be dependent upon his sobriety. She was not able to sponsor me, the person I chose or the person I asked, for a couple months because she had to finish school. But what she said I could do was I could call her regularly, which, by the way, is being sponsored instead of having a sponsor. There's a difference between having a sponsor and being sponsored. So I was started down the journey of being sponsored, which means there was a crisis, I called her. I had a question, I called her. We went to meetings together. And she started me on the journey of the steps. Now, my first step was very simple. It was, I'm powerless over whether he uses or not, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with my life. I lived off that first step for at least a year. And I bet if I'm 100% honest with you all, I lived off that step at my core for 4 years. It shifted a little bit because at some point I was reading my journals. You know, that mascara kept crying, running down my face, and people at work kept saying, "What's wrong with you?" And I went and reread my journals, and I realized that my life was unmanageable. So I was able to admit a little bit that I wasn't able to stop him from using drugs and alcohol, and that my life kind of wasn't all together. But it wasn't until May 14th, and there's a daily reader in the ODAT that talks about the difference between surrender and compliance. And in there it says that compliance says there'll come a day. And true surrender, I'm not thinking, oh, if I listen to in a meeting and I hear so-and-so say blah, 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 I can go home and tell him that blah, blah, blah said this and you should really try that. Or if I'm reading in the big book, I can find out blah, you know, and then tell him, I heard this, I think you should read, I saw this story back here, I think you should read the story. I was always, in the back of my mind, always thinking about something that I could say or do that would get him sober. That was constant for those first 4 years in recovery. And the reason that May 14th was so powerful for me was because I write down the things that you say on these little index cards. It was the only way I could remember what you guys said to me, because otherwise I used manipulation, control, fear, worry, silent treatment. That's all I had in my back pocket. I had nothing else to bring to the table except for those things. So when I started to learn this too shall pass one day at a time, the more hopeless the man, the better. I used that a lot. An alcoholic has to be pretty badly mangled before they commence to ask for help. I used that. I started writing those things down, and for some reason or another, I had a great idea that if I make him a copy of every one of those index cards, that he would read something on one of those index cards and be sober. And I was in my hotel room. They come in packs of hundreds. I had bought packs and packs of them. I had 500 packs finished, or 500 of them finished. I still had a stack that I had to continue to copy, and I read that. And when I read it, I realized that I had no surrender whatsoever. I still was trying to manage the whole show. I still thought that I had power and I was going to be able to get him to stop using. In the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it has the ABCs. B, probably no human power could relieve their alcoholism. I wrote in my big book, B, that probably no human power could relieve their alcoholism, and that includes you, Marion. Because you see, I thought I had power. I thought that was except for him, except for them, except for his mother, except for the whoever. I honestly thought I had power to change somebody else's life. I don't. Unfortunately, I don't even have power to change my own life. The next thing says, and God could and would if he were sought. I lack the power to change myself. I lack the power to remove my own character defects. I lack the power to alter my state of mind. I lack the power sometimes to take action or to be nice or to introduce myself to someone. I lack the power of that. But with God's help, he will do for me what I can't do for myself. Step three at the beginning was very easy because I just said, okay, yeah, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I did not know what that meant. I didn't know what a will was. I didn't know what my life was. But that didn't really matter. We just got into the work. Now, I did not do my original steps out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I did it off the wall, which got me an off-the-wall recovery. But I did get to tell somebody all my life story. And it does say in the book that if we don't tell someone else all our life story, that we are likely to, and here it says, drink again, in my case, go insane, not have serenity or peace of mind. My first sponsor gave me a card that said, peace of mind does not mean to be without trouble, hard work, or noise. It means to be amongst those three things and be calm in the heart. We can be happy, joyous, and free whether the alcoholic or addict is still using or not. My sobriety does not depend upon their serenity, or my serenity does not depend upon their sobriety. I remember we were in a room about this size, and I was sitting over at the edge of the room, and she said, hey, is that all you got to say to me? As she's walking out the door over there. And I said, no, it's not. I slept with somebody I didn't know. And she's like, okay, bye. But that was really important to me because I also had an image, and that image was I was squeaky clean and I would never do anything like that. And I had that weighing on my conscience for years because I even said out loud to others, I have never had a one-night stand ever, but that wasn't true. So it was important to get that little thing off my chest really quick, and I appreciated so much that all she did was like, okay, bye, see you later. And I was also glad she asked me the question at the end of step five that said, hey, did you leave anything out? Anything else you want to lay here at our God's feet and my feet before I walk out the door? Because it's those secrets. It's those lies. It's that image of myself that I'm not able to uphold. When I first came into recovery, I used to say, hi, my name is Marion. I compromise my values. Living in active addiction created an opportunity for me to have morals that did not match my actions. And there was plenty of them. And I could not drop my standards low enough to match the things that I was doing, I was saying, I was dreaming. At one point in time, I used to dream of brick bathtub, head in hand, smashing his head onto this brick bathtub, blood splattering everywhere. It was a constant dream of mine, constant. I used to have a sponsee that said she was either homicidal or suicidal. Those were her two states. depending on the day. But the dreams really disturbed me. And I got to be free of things like that when I put myself in the care of God. I eventually... I eventually came to a place in 9 that I had some amends to make where there wasn't any forgiveness. And it's quite challenging to make amends when you still hate. And I was not at that point shown the prayer between columns 3 and column 4. This was our course where we pray for the person that we have written inventory about. I hadn't been shown that part of recovery yet. So I called my sponsor up, and I was between jobs, and I travel for my job. So I called her up, and I said, what time do you get up for work? And she said, 5 o'clock. And I said, you willing to get up at 4:30? I had a flight the next morning at like 11 o'clock or something. And she said, yeah, I'm willing. What do you have in mind? And I said, I really need to forgive some people. I was thinking that if I brought some birthday candles over, and you provided a candle that we could sit out in your yard in the middle of the night, or in the middle of the, I guess 4:30 is the middle of the night, but, and I could light each one of those candles, and they could represent, I could tell you about who I'm forgiving, and they could represent the forgiveness. And when they burned down to the ground, we would know that the forgiveness was complete. And she said, I would love to do that with you. So the next morning, I went over to her house at 4:30, and we did that. I honestly do not remember how many people I did, and I honestly do not remember what I forgave them for. My mother had multiple sclerosis. She got it when I was 13 years old, and I was suicidal from 6th grade to 12th grade. And the only thing and the only kind of conversation I could have with my mother was, she would say, how are you? And I'd say, get away from me. And she'd say, what would you like for dinner? And I'd say, stop talking to me. You're ruining my life. I was not able to have a conversation with my mother at all. I came to find out the reason I treated my mother that way was because I couldn't be honest with her. When she said, how are you? I couldn't say, I feel like killing myself. I'm unhappy. I'm depressed. I'm suicidal. I wasn't able to say that. So my distraction was yelling and screaming and throwing a fit. When I forgave her, she was the very first candle that I lit that morning. And she was the very last candle to burn out. It's important for me to not be carrying grudges along, to let go, to be free. That journey through the steps, that first journey through the steps got me to 12, and then it was time to sponsor. And I had no idea how to do that. And I was scared out of my mind that I would even be asked to do that. I had a sponsor at the time that I called, but I also had a number of people. One of them was 35 years in recovery, and the other one was 20-something years in recovery, and another one of them was 20-something years in recovery, and I called them constantly. What do I tell the sponsee? She just called me and said, blah, 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 I don't know what to do. And the other thing that happened at that time period was I started listening to speaker tapes, and I started listening to big book speaker tapes. And a gentleman in Denver, Colorado, started taking the Cocaine Anonymous people through the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was on a day that I wasn't able to be there, so I would get all the information from those that were there that week. And I started listening to tapes to supplement because I couldn't be there. My life changed at that point. As it says, I got rocketed into a fourth dimension that I didn't even knew existed. This is my third edition of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the book that I got in, whatever, 1998 or something. Well used, falling apart. I brought it because it's smaller. It's my lifeline. But if I work with a sponsee that has a fourth edition, I now work out of a fourth edition with her. If I have a sponsee that has a third edition, I work out of a third edition. And that is so that we can be equals. This big book here had so much power for me. It looks so cool. But it separated me. I needed to not be the person that had all the information or all of the experience. So after 14 years, I humbled myself and got a fourth edition. And it's kind of new and fancy, and none of the pages are falling out. I started working with I had a male sponsor for a while, which was absolutely fantastic. He knew everything about this book, been around a really long time, had a lot of power and great direction. In fact, we were going over I still only have one amends that I have not been able to make. And when I was going through step 9 with him, I brought it to him. So that he could be up to date with everything that was going on with me, and it was the alcoholic love triangle. And the amends was to the woman in the triangle. And he was reading directly out of the book. He said, what is the debris that you have to sweep away? What's the damage that you have done? And he was asking me directly out of the book the questions. He was changing the sentences into questions. And I didn't have a lot of answers. You know, I called them in the middle of the night until they answered the phone. I drove all over the place. I did whatever. And I just kept answering. And I was getting frustrated, and I was praying while we were talking. And he just kept repeating the same sentences over. And then it dawned on me. I never honored the love that the two of them had for each other. I never once considered that God put them together. All I did was try to break them up. Sometimes all I did was beg him to go to her and leave me, which I was the stable one, so that wasn't going to be happening with an active alcoholic, but nonetheless. And you know what happens when you become clear on what your amends are? The willingness just shoots right through the ceiling. Because I had what I call godly sorrow. I had a remorse for my actions, for the fact that I tried to get in the way of a love that they had for each other. I still have not found her. I still continue to look for her. I talked with him a couple years ago. He actually said to me, I think it would not be good if you call her and make amends to her. I do know where she is, but I'm not telling you. And part of that is just accepting. God has a time for all of this. I said I was an atheist when I arrived here, and I didn't really care for the word God or him or anything else. So what has happened, you've heard me talk a lot about God. What happened was I was at the very, very first thing that happened was he kept telling me, read We Agnostics. And I would open to the first couple words and I'd say, this thing is written in 1930. What? I don't understand what you're... No. And I'd close it back up. And he'd say, read We Agnostics. So then I had another book with me at work. And a gentleman that I work with came up to me. And he asked me if I was in recovery. And I said, if I was a member of the fellowship. And I said, no, I'm not. Somebody that I love is a member of the fellowship. He said... He broke his anonymity, told me he had been in recovery for 14 years, then he left. A couple hours later, he comes back, and this is all he says to me, and I'm an atheist at the time. He says, I was sitting in a cafeteria one day, and a guy walked up to me, and he said, can I sit down? And my friend said, sure. And the guy said, do you believe in God? And my friend said, yours or mine? It was at that exact moment that God came to live in my heart, because I no longer had to believe in any other person's concept of God. I believed in my God, whatever that meant, and as small of a concept of that it was. That's all I needed. It says in the book, that's all you need for a beginning, And he gave me that beginning. This gentleman that I had worked with for years that I tried to avoid because I didn't like gave me a relationship with God. I saw him at a state convention a couple of years later and went running up to him and said, "Thank you. You honestly, sincerely are the one who brought me God." We never know how our stories can touch somebody and how our experience will alter somebody, give somebody else strength or hope or courage to go do what they need to do or to change their belief system. I have a very strong step three today. If I was to call my sponsor and complain about something or bitch about something or tell her how my day is not going the way I want it to do, which is not usually what I do at all. But if I was to call her and say that to me, she would say, "Did you take step three today?" And of course the answer would be yes, even if I didn't, right? And then she would say, "Did you mean it?" But for years, I've been practicing, "Thy will not mine be done." It's the way I end my prayers. "Thy will not mine be done. Thy will not mine be done. Thy will not mine be done." That gets me out of the equation. Because nowhere in there does it say Marion. Unless I've, go to the courthouse and change my name to Thy, it doesn't say Marion and "Thy will not mine be done." When I was working with the male sponsor, he would often ask me to fifth step things with a female sponsor, with a female person. I started doing that, and we became very good friends. And I wanted to call her with every single thing that was happening in my life. And I realized that was the type of sponsor I wanted because I wanted to be sponsored. I wanted to call her and ask her questions. I wanted to call her and learn something new. I wanted to call her and be vulnerable. I wanted to call her and change. So I asked her to sponsor me. And when we first started doing the work together, I was at a position where I no longer wanted to be single. I had been single for 6 years. And I didn't want to be that way any longer. And I needed to look at who I was and what I was doing and what I was bringing to the table that was supporting being single. I didn't want to get married, by the way. It was never, ever on my radar. So we started looking at the way I dressed, the way I thought, the way I acted. In the Two Wives in the Family afterwards, it talks about when a man is not able to do what men do, women put on the trousers. When Bill was not able to bring home the bacon, Lois went to work at the department store. I loved working at the department store and anything else that brought home the bacon. I loved being in charge. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Myself, as a family member, I am in a relationship with an addict because I like the effect produced when they're actively using. I like to be able to make all the decisions. I like to be able to be in charge of the finances. I like to be able to think that I am better than you because you are a rotten addict and I am the sober person holding this whole entire household together. I liked it. I had to honestly admit that I felt more alive in the midst of the chaos, that I had purpose, that I had, I had a mission. I liked being in charge of things. Those are all masculine qualities. And when the masculine meets the masculine, it's not very pretty. So step seven is about my character defects. And a lot of the things that were blocking me from having a relationship with a man were my character defects. I never thought that anybody was doing anything right, that I was the only one that could do it. But what happened was I got to this place where what I had, which was the people I was sponsoring, my very close family of coworkers, lots of financial stability, lots of personal items, but I had an empty heart. And I remember I was staring at my spreadsheet, because I have a spreadsheet that tells me everything about my finances and my life, and I realized I didn't want that anymore. I'd give up that entire thing. I'd give up all of those characteristics that brought me such success so that I could be in a relationship with someone. I had a friend that asked me what I thought about men. And I started making up a bunch of bullshit, this, that, blah, 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 blah. And he paused and he said very firmly to me, he said, "No, I honestly want to know what you think about men." And I said, "They're liars. They're cheats. They mess up everything they touch. They just they're lazy. They're weak." And I said to him, he's not in recovery. I said to him, "You know what you just did? You got me to do a ideal sex inventory. You got me to look at myself sexually." I hung up the phone with him and I said, "No man would ever, in his right mind, walk into those words." And I knew where they came from. I knew they came from living in an alcoholic love triangle for 8 years. I knew they came from living with a crack cocaine addict and being in charge of everything. So I said to God, "What are your 5 words, God? What do you want me to see men? How do you want me to see men? I am willing to change my vision. I am willing to have a new outlook. I am willing to let go of being in charge of everything and wearing the trousers. I am willing to wear a skirt. Please show me what you would like me to see men as." And it took a few days of that prayer, maybe three or so. He said, "You can trust men like you trust me." Meaning I can trust a man like I trust God. That men are strong. That men have my best interest at heart. That men have a purpose. And that purpose isn't to take care of you, Marion. A man comes to this planet with a purpose. Support his purpose. And the last one was that he's a beacon. You can follow him. Next day, one day later, my current husband asked me to go on a date with him. I did not want to go. I tried to avoid that at best case I could. I tried to sneak away in the dark in the middle of a camp out or a fire, what are those, fireside meetings or whatever those are called. I tried to sneak out at that moment in time so he would not see me. We parked right next in front of our friend's house, so he ended up walking me to my car, asking me out. But while I was walking to get away from him, I was also praying this: "I'll do whatever you want me to do, God. I do not know what is best for me. I do not know what you have planned for me. And I am willing to do whatever you want me to do, God." So he walked me back to my car. I said yes. We've pretty much been inseparable since that moment. He had 3 years of sobriety when we met. Absolute heaven. I got to be something that I'd always wanted, which was a CA couple. I got to be an example of relationship and togetherness and partnership and teamwork. And then he used. It was so bizarre because the day that he did, There are plenty of times where we haven't talked. Plenty of times in our relationship where we just missed each other. You miss the phone when it rings, and I called and he didn't answer, and my stomach sunk, and my throat restricted, and my mind started that chatter, and I thought, this is so bizarre. He's sober. Why are those things happening? And a few hours later, I found out that he had... Actually, I didn't find out for sure until the next morning when he called and told me that he had used. But what had happened was I had 14 years of recovery at that point in time. And I was able to... I was able to go back to basics. I was able to pray myself to sleep. I was able to be happy, joyous, and free, whether he was using or not. There are some things that you do have to do when you live in active addiction. You do have to move things from your house if you don't want them given to the crack man. I have some artwork that left the house. And everything that I kind of wanted to have make it through this, I thought I had taken out of the house, but I had not. Many of it made it out. But what that taught me was that I care far more about people than I do things. There's a sentence in the Two Wives that says, do not condemn your alcoholic husband no matter what he says or does. I didn't know what the word condemn meant. I looked it up in the dictionary. Condemn means do not pronounce them incurable. So I held this space that he then could get sober again. That this would not be permanent. This too shall pass. And then I placed him in the hands of not only God, but the fellowship, knowing that when he came back, he would have a group of people that would support him. But I can tell you, and we've done it twice, he had sobriety and then went and used again, and we've done it twice in our marriage. We also have a sign in our wall that says, together we can make it. You know, unlike those other relationships that I was in, I was now in a marriage, and I was now in, we both have recovery. And he was, strangely enough, able to use his recovery while he was using, which is bizarre to me, but he was able to practice certain principles. He was able to be honest with me. Yes, I stole that. Yes, I pawned that. Yes, this is gone. And I didn't have to say, you blah, blah, blah. I said, thank you for letting me know. I trust that there is a solution to the disease of addiction. And I knew it would come back into our house at some point in time. I just didn't know when. So I stood strong. By strong, I mean next to my sponsor, in meetings, sponsoring others, in the literature. And I continued my work. So... it can be done. A lot of times when you're living with an addict, you think the only solution is to just cut them off, never want to see them again, that abstinence is meaning I'm never going to see an alcoholic again in my life or an addict again in my life. And the truth is they're everywhere. I'll just find another one. I can point them out a mile away. When I used to volunteer at the Boulder Jail with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that was the only time I was attracted to anybody, when I was sitting in there and they were wearing orange, yellow, red, blue, white. Those are the only people I was attracted to those 6 years I was single. I am one of you. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to share my story and to share that there is hope. And I also want to say that I know we are a small fellowship, that Al-Anon is a small fellowship, but we're here for each other. We don't have to do this alone. The first word of step one is we. Together we can make it. So thank you for letting me share my story.
to read the do's and don'ts.
Hi, Jess. Do forget, do be honest with yourself, do be humble, do take it easy, attention is harmful, do play, find recreation and hobbies, do keep trying whenever you fail, do learn the facts about drug addiction, alcoholism, do attend coma meetings often, and do pray. Don't be self-righteous, don't try to dominate, nag, scold, and complain, don't lose your temper, don't try to push anyone but yourself, don't keep bringing up the past. Don't keep checking up on the addict, alcoholic. Don't dwell on self-pity. Don't make threats you don't intend to carry out. Don't be overprotective and don't be dharma.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks. At this time, we'll pass it in love to, so we may observe the seventh tradition. I once again want to thank Marianne for sharing her story with us, and it was lovely. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.